World War II. It's known as the Greatest Generation. And these are their stories. It's the World War II Project. Here are your hosts, Americhicks Molly Vogt and Kim Munson.
Welcome to the Americhicks World War II Project. I'm Molly Vogt.
And I'm Kim Munson.
We are excited to be able to interview folks from the Greatest Generation who actually took their time and their treasure over to serve in the great Second World War. And we've got some in the European theater, some in the Pacific theater. We want to hear all the stories because we know that every single one of them is different. And the fact that they risked everything for tyranny and to go to lands they'd never heard of to protect people they would never meet is a really, really big deal. And so we're excited today to be on the phone with Les Anderson. Les, welcome to the Americhicks Show.
Yes.
Les, we'd like to talk about your story today. Would you mind telling us what branch and unit you were a part of in World War II?
Well, I was in the Navy in the amphibious forces.
All right. And Les, we want to first, before we get started, just say thank you. Thank you. We know that there was so much that you did, that you saw, you sacrificed, you lost when you were in the Second World War. We know it's not easy to talk about it. We will never forget. That's why we're asking for your story today, so that future generations understand about the sacrifice and the cost and the effect of war. So thank you. So Les Anderson, you served in the Navy in the amphibious area. I know that you were you served in the Pacific Theater. Would you mind telling us when and where you were born?
I was born in Hutchinson, Kansas, in December 20th, 1918.
All right. And when can you tell us where you were when you heard that Pearl Harbor was bombed?
I was working in California. I was living in Hollywood, California, and that's where I heard the news.
Oh, so had you already graduated then from high school or college by then?
Yes. Oh. Yes, I was working out there.
What was your job at that time?
I was working for Lockheed Aircraft on the building a P-38 fighter plane.
Wow. All right. Well, did you already know that you wanted to join the military in the future?
Well, I tried to join the military in the prior year, and they wouldn't accept my application because I was married, and I tried the National Guard. I wanted to go with them because my friends was in the National Guard, mm-hmm. and they accepted me at first, and then decided that they couldn't accept me. So I tried the Navy, and they wouldn't accept me. So that's when I went to California to go to work for Lockheed.
And what year was that, Les?
Pardon?
What year was that?
I can't understand.
What year was that? Was this before or after Pearl Harbor?
1941.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because that's where he was when he heard that Pearl Harbor was bombed.
Okay.
Yes.
And do you mind, Les, telling us about that day?
About the job?
About the day that you heard about Pearl Harbor.
Well, my wife and I was going to drive out through Orange County, and I'd gone out and got the car. And she come out and said that Japan had attacked the United States, and I said, "Oh, that's not possible. That little country wouldn't do that." I said, "Well, that's what they say on the radio." And we went ahead and drove around through Orange County. And when we went back to go back home that evening, we come back through Long Beach and picked up the Los Angeles Times with the headlines that they had been attacked, and that made it positive that it had happened to me.
Okay, so then when did you decide that you wanted to get into the military? So you're in California and you're working for Lockheed Martin. When did you actually get into the military then?
Well, I'd worked for Lockheed a couple of years, and they sent me over to the Burbank Technical Institute and to teach war production workers some skills to have when they go over to go working in the plant. And when I went over there, I was working then for the Los Angeles School Board. And I notified my draft board in Kansas that I had gone to work with the National School, or Los Angeles School Board. And I worked several months for them, teaching adults the skills that they needed to go to work when they went over to the plant. And after several months, Lockheed decided that their hiring level was sufficient, that they wouldn't need to be training any more people over at their Burbank Technical Institute. And so they recalled me to come back to the plant, and I went back as a final assembly and flight inspector for the P-38. And my draft board decided that change my draft rating to A-1. And so they sent me a notice to go to Los Angeles for examination, and I went and passed. And once you passed, you had 21 days to finish clean up your business and before they could call you. And so my wife didn't want to stay in Los Angeles. She wanted to go back to Kansas, where her folks were. And so we went back to Kansas and went to the draft board and told them I was ready to go. And they said they put me off for about 3 months, that they had their quota full. And so I notified them that I was going back to Los Angeles and go back to work with Lockheed. And in about 3 days, I got my notice to that we go to do the reception center. And so I did, and Fort Leavenworth. And had the physical there and interviews. And I was fortunate enough to be accepted by the Navy. And from there, I went to Great Lakes boot camp. And
Just a quick question. Jumping in here, first of all, you were married. Did you have any children at that time?
Pardon?
Did you have any children?
I had one son.
Okay, and how old was he?
Well, he was about 1 year old.
Oh, this is a big deal. So then you and your wife decided when you were going to be joining the military that she would go back to Kansas so that she would be around family so that they could help.
That's where her folks were.
Okay. One other question regarding the P-38. We've heard that that was quite the plane. Tell us a little bit about the P-38.
Well, it was a two-engine with two booms and a cockpit on the center section there. And it was very speedy, and it had a cannon in the nose and several machine guns that didn't have to be cycled through the propeller like some of the planes did. Single-engine planes, they had to cycle a machine gun with their propeller speed so that they wouldn't shoot their propeller off. But that wasn't a problem with the P-38. They had the nose, and it was a very speedy plane, and it was long range. They could put auxiliary tanks under the wings, under the center section wings, and fly it all the way to Europe.
Well, and there was just a pilot. It was just a one-person plane, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was just a one-person plane, yes.
Okay. Now, one other thing I had never really thought of, but you just mentioned that one of the positives was that it would not shoot its propeller off, which would imply that there were planes that had that problem?
Yes, there were planes that were the machine guns had to fire through the... the propellers was rotating, and it had to be recycled. It had to be cycled so that it would fire when the blade wasn't in front of the machine gun.
Oh, my gosh.
And that took a little engineering to do that. But the Lockheed was free from that because artillery was in the nose of the plane.
Okay. Wow. I hadn't really thought about that. And yes, we've heard that that was quite the sweet little plane to fly. And the long range on that, the fact that it was just one person. And, you know, Molly, I hadn't really thought about the fact that it would be the pilot that would be piloting the plane, that would have machine guns, figuring out the cannon, because we had interviewed Major Frederick Arnold that I think he flew P-38s. And I hadn't really thought about all the things that had to happen, Les.
It was an engineering feat that somebody had to solve.
All right. And so, Les, so it was 1941, obviously, when Pearl Harbor happened. You were working for Lockheed. And then it took several months for you to actually get into the Navy. And you did get into the Navy. You went to Fort Leavenworth and then to Great Lakes.
Well, it was 1944 before I went into the Navy.
1944. Okay. So you had a little while longer.
Yeah. I had several years with Lockheed.
Okay.
And the manager at Lockheed said, you don't have to go. Said, I've never lost anybody to the draft board yet. And if you don't want to go, you don't have to. And I thought over a little bit, and I thought, well, it's my duty. And my friends are all fighting somewhere. It's my duty that I try to go, too.
Yeah. And what
so
did you...
I didn't accept his offer and went ahead and let the draft board draft me.
And how did your wife feel about that, Les?
Well, she kind of agreed that the way I felt, that it was all right. I'm sure that she'd rather I would have stayed there at Lockheed, but since I felt like I wanted to do it and it was my duty, why she agreed to it, and there was no problem there.
And Les, did you have any siblings that also joined the Navy, or
did I have what?
Any siblings, brothers or sisters, or
no. As far as I know, I was the only one of. My kin that has ever been in there, maybe.
All right. Well, let's go. You were going through boot camp. You went to Great Lakes boot camp.
Well, from there, I wanted to go into the aviation branch of the Navy, and they said, no, you're going to radar school. And of the 130 boots in the boot camp, I was the only one selected to go to radar school. And that was a 3-week 3-week school at Virginia Beach, Virginia. And after the 3-week school there, I went to Newport, Rhode Island, and to a ship detail. They was building a crew for the ships that were in being built at that time. And so I was at Newport for 3 months before the ship that I was assigned to was completed and ready for sea.
And what ship was that? What were you assigned to, Les?
It was the USS Hanover, APA 116, amphibious attack transport.
Okay. Okay, and did you think you would be going to the Pacific Theater, or did you know at that time?
Well, no, I didn't know where I was going. And picked up the ship in Pascagoula, Mississippi, and we went up the river to New Orleans, and they did some work on it there. And then we went to over to a place on Mississippi and loaded up a cargo of beer and 500 Marines and 1,000 Seabees, and went through the canal to Pearl Harbor.
Okay. You know what? Let's stop right there, Les. We're going to go to break here. This is absolutely fascinating. We'll want to ask you if you were a plank owner on the Hanover, and also if you were part of the shakedown crew. So we're going to go to break, and when we come back, if you can answer those questions. But before we do that, I mean, it is a great time regarding sports right now. It's playoff season for the Pro Football League, and one of the great places to be is Hooters Restaurants. They have all kinds of great football playoff specials. Molly and I love their smoked wings, which are half the calories. I also, when I splurge, I like the boneless wings as well. So you can get over there. There's all kinds of TVs. It'll show each of your games that you're watching. Or if you want to just be with family at home, you know, check out Grubhub. Have them deliver right to your door, and you will look like a hero. So more information about Hooters Restaurants, check out HootersColorado.com. That's HootersColorado.com. And be sure and let them know that you know the Americhicks. And we'll be right back. We are talking with Les Anderson. He is a World War II veteran. And another question we want to ask you is, I'm looking at this and I'm thinking you're going to have your 100th birthday within the next few days. Is that right?
It's about 10 days away.
Okay. Right. Well, we'll be right back. This is the Americhicks, Molly Vogt and Kim Munson. We are talking with Les Anderson.
Welcome back to the Americhicks World War II Project with Molly Vogt and Kim Munson. We're excited that we're on the line with Les Anderson. He served in the Second World War in the Pacific Theater in the Navy, and he was originally on the USS Hanover, APA 116, and even before that, he worked on P-38 with Lockheed Martin. Les, you were telling us about right before you were leaving the United States, you were headed to Pearl Harbor. But before we get to that, we wanted to find out if you were a plank owner and a part of the shakedown.
Was a pardon? I didn't understand that.
Were you a part of the shakedown on your ship, the USS Hanover?
Yes.
Anything you care to tell us about that? We hear it's a pretty exciting event.
Well, the shakedown was at Galveston, Texas, and they put you through all of the processes that you would need to do if it was a battle situation. And it's about 3 weeks training, and or it takes about 3 weeks to process through there. And any ship that doesn't get a a certain grade, why they don't let them go into battle duty until they turn them into a training ship. But we were accepted as ready for war duty.
All right. And so you said then you headed to Pearl Harbor. And was this also in 1944?
Yes.
Okay. So tell us about Pearl Harbor.
Well, we were there a few days, and I could see the damage at Hickman Field and the ships in the harbor and the oily surface of the water. It looked horrible. It looked like it's really been a rough go there.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a few days there. Would you want me to continue on?
Yes, sir.
Well, after a few days there, we went back to the States to Portland, Oregon, to the we loaded up troops there and headed for the Pacific. And I think that was about the 1st of July of 44. No, that would be 45.
Okay.
And we went from Portland to...
You know, Les, I'm thinking maybe that was 44 because that was before Okinawa, right?
Yeah.
So that probably would have been 44.
Well, no, I didn't go into the service until 44, so it was 45.
Okay.
That I went in, that we went to, went west. We went to Eniwetok and refueled there, and we went solo there. And then we had to wait there, and several other ships come along, and there was two destroyers come from the war zone and to escort us to the next stop for us, and we went from there to the Ulithi Atolls.
Okay.
And we were there a few days, and there was more ships come in and to form the convoy to go on to Okinawa.
Okay.
And we had some time there at Ulithi.
Now, Les, you said that you'd had a couple of ships that had arrived that had been in battle.
Yeah.
What went through your mind? I mean, certainly, guys that have been through battle, they've seen different things. I mean, how did that work? What was going through your mind at that time?
What went through my mind, I said, here's two poor little destroyers come to escort us back to where he's been in battle. And I felt kind of odd that... they had been there, and I hadn't.
Uh-huh.
And they escorted us over to the Ulithi Atoll. There was a couple times that I guess they got a sonar indication that they would dash off and drop some of those...
the depth charges?
Yeah, depth charges,
mm-hmm.
And circle around and finally decide that there's nothing there. We'd go on and then come back, and we'd start the escort again. And that happened a couple of times on the way to Ulithi.
Okay. Now, you know what? Let's back up just a little bit, because you said you were part of the amphibious forces that that went on shore in Okinawa. Talk a little bit about the training to be part of the amphibious forces.
Well, we had boats. I think we had 30-some boats, landing craft. Those are the ones that have the valve drops down on the beach. And you take them in to the designated place that's signed to you, and you drop the beach at a bow down, and then your troops, they have to make their way on in from there onto the shore. And they go down the cargo nets to get in the boats. So we have to unload the boats first. And that's a particular, got to be done just exactly right, because you're unloading boats on both sides, and you don't want any confusion or anything. So you have to have a crew that has excelled at handling those booms and winches to lower those bigger landing craft. The smaller ones was in racks on the side that was automatic. They could unfold them, and they would lay the boat down into the water. And but the heavier boats had to be lifted off a boom, and that took a trained crew to do that.
Now, were you under fire when they were trying to do? I mean, you would be far enough out, right?
When we got to Okinawa to unload them, there wasn't much fire left. What troops was left on there had holed up into the caves on the island. And they were trying to get them out of the caves. And so we didn't see much of the battle. And we weren't in that much of a danger, which was kind of a disappointment to us. But,
and a relief for your wife, I'm sure. So
yeah, it was for the good of the cause that they had, the Japanese were being defeated. But
so, and what kind of then landing craft were you on? Were you on one of the ones that had to be lowered over the side of the boat?
No, I was on the ship's crew. My duty was as a radar operator and navigating while we were underway.
Okay.
And once we were in a combat zone and they dropping the boats in, we didn't have that duty. We had the duty to see that air raids, that our air radar was operating, and but I was a surface search operator.
Okay.
So I was on that type of radar.
All right. And if you just tuned in, we're speaking with Les Anderson. This is the AmeriChicks in our World War II project. Les served in the Pacific Theater during World War II on the USS Hanover, APA 116. And he went to radar school, and he was doing radar and navigating. When you were at Okinawa, Les, you said that you got there pretty much the majority of the fighting was over, but they were still trying to hold the caves. What could you see anything from the boat? And if so, what did it look like?
Well, there was a little LCMs that had mounted rocket launchers on them, and they was driving up and down across the harbor there firing rockets into those caves, and then they'd turn around and come back and fire them back in, coming back. And they was trying to get them Japanese out of those caves because they went, that was about the only way they could get them out.
Mm-hmm. Well, and did you ever see any kamikaze planes?
No, but we had them come over at night. But a half hour before sunset and a half hour before sunrise, we made the... got the order to make smoke, and the ship had some kind of device that could make a smoke screen, and then they had to put some small boats in the water with a portable smoke maker device in them, and they circled the ship, and it once they got that fog laid or that smoke laid, we pretty well invisible.
Huh.
We could hear the kamikaze planes flying over, but on the side that we're on the Naha Ko side, and there was the Pennsylvania battleship Pennsylvania was on the other side in Buckner Bay, and one of the kamikazes found it and did some minor damage to it. It didn't sink it or destroy it, but they was having some problems with water, and so they was requesting a portable water pumps from all other ships to bring them in to Pennsylvania. Its code name was Bulldog, and Bulldog was calling for portable water pumps, and I don't know how severe the damage was, but that was the only one that I knew that was damaged while we were still there.
All right. But you never had to pick up any of the members on the other boat and bring them onto the USS Hanover?
No, we never did. We had the war plans for the invasion of Tokyo, and we studied those war plans. It designated a location for every ship in the squadron and the time that they was to be there and to discharge their troops and to recede and back out, and then at a certain time go back in to pick up any wounded that would possibly be there, and bring them back to the ship for treatment. So we did see the war plans for invasion of Tokyo, but unfortunately we didn't have to use them.
So, Les Anderson, were you ever afraid during all this?
No, silly as it sounds, I never was. Being young, I don't think any of us was afraid. I never saw any indication of it. I guess we thought we'd all be there forever.
Wow.
And I guess it was right.
Wow. What, you know, it's pretty amazing. I mean, when you look at your generation, this generation of young guys, I mean, you guys were young. And you left your wife and your little one-year-old at home,
yeah,
and you went and stood and fought against evil and tyranny. Why?
Well, that's I guess we all felt like that was our duty, and we'd do the best we could.
Wow.
Well, you sure did. Let's go to break. When we come back, I want to talk. I know you know you didn't do the invasion of Tokyo, but since you were studying the war plans at that time, I wonder if you wouldn't mind sharing a little bit about what those plans looked like, since we don't see those very often.
Okay. Does that work for you, Les?
Pardon? Yes.
Okay, all great. Right. We'll go to break. This is the Americhicks, Molly Vogt and Kim Munson. We are talking with World War II veteran Les Anderson, who is going to be 100 years old within the next few days. Happy birthday, Les Anderson. We will be right back.
Welcome back to the Americhicks World War II Project. If anybody, if you know a World War II veteran, we would love to have their story. Please reach out to us on the Americhicks website. And you can hear these stories every Sunday here on Easy 1430 AM. And of course, on our website, Americhicks.com, we have over 100 interviews with World War II veterans.
What an honor.
Everybody's story is different. Les Anderson is on the phone with us right now. He served in the Pacific Theater on the USS Hanover, APA 116, and he was in charge of the radar and navigating. And he was telling us about his time at Okinawa. And after Okinawa, they had been studying the war plans for the invasion of Tokyo. It didn't happen, but Les, is there anything about the invasion that was going to take place that you'd like to share with us?
Well, the only thing I can share with you is we were one of the ships that was held over there at after the Japanese surrendered, and we went from Okinawa with a military government first to Korea, and left them. Army military government there, and went back to Okinawa and picked up another military government and took it to Japan or China, Taku, or the harbor for Beijing, China. And from there, we were ordered to Manila in the Philippines for a change of command. And we went to Manila, and from there we went with a convoy to Hong Kong, China, and picked up the Chinese troops and took them north. The first time we went up to Tsinghuatu, China, and where they was trying to stop Mao Zedong from coming down through China. And we went from there. Well, there we got caught in a typhoon. And
tell us about that. What was that like?
Well, this ship was pretty solid. Just rolled from side to side, but the captain thought that we could outrun it, and he took off in the wrong direction.
Oops.
From Manila, and we kept getting calls. Our code name was Boomtown, and we kept getting calls from Manila, Boomtown, Boomtown, where are you? And he'd say, don't answer that. And finally, we talked him out of the idea that we could outrun that typhoon, because the typhoon was moving along the same speed we was, turn around and head through it and go to Manila. And so we did that. And we made two trips from Hong Kong to northern China. The second time we went to Tsingtao, China. We couldn't get all the way up because the troops had come down. And then from there we went back to Okinawa and loaded army troops and took them to Tacoma, Washington. And from there I was sent home for a discharge. And I left the ship there at Tacoma.
Okay. Backing up just a little bit, you were in kind of the tail end of the Battle of Okinawa, and you know, we've talked to a number of World War II veterans that they've thought that if there was an actual invasion of Japan, that the loss of life, both by the Japanese people as well as the Americans, would have been significant.
It would have been huge.
So, two things. First of all, when did you hear that the atomic bombs had been dropped, and what went through your mind?
Well, I didn't know what atomic bomb was, but we heard that it had destroyed one city, and then later we got the word that it had destroyed another, and so we decided that was pretty significant weapon,
yeah,
and that that should stop the war, and it did.
Right, and I think that kids today, and actually I think for at least a generation, we've really not been taught the complete picture about the atomic bomb. George H.W. Bush just passed on. I was reading something regarding when he was rescued. He was a young American flyer, and he was rescued. The other guys on his plane did not survive. But they said that the Japanese soldiers actually were cutting up and eating American flyers. I don't think that we quite understand just that. There was some really evil, nasty stuff going on the part of some of the stuff going on with the Japanese leadership.
Oh yeah, they treated the Koreans and the Chinese very roughly, and they was in poor shape. I know China was in very poor shape.
And so there was really a concern to try to get this this war stopped, and that was one of the reasons why the decision was made to drop the atomic bombs instead of doing an invasion, which, again, almost to a man, they've said to us, Les Anderson, that there would have been a much, much greater loss of life if the atomic bombs had
been a much greater loss. I think it was the only solution.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And Les Anderson, you mentioned that, you know, in the Navy on your boat, the USS Hanover, on the way back to the United States, you brought some Army troops back with you. Do you have any stories from talking to them that they shared with you that you'd like to share with us?
No, I didn't. I didn't have much opportunity to be around them.
Okay.
That when we was carrying the Chinese troops north, we had to have a couple of burials at sea that the Chinese troops perished on their way. They was in very poor shape, and there's some of them lost their lives on their trip up there, and we had to perform that performance at sea, and that's quite a solemn performance, see a burial at sea. The body is sewed up in sailcloth, and a link of anchor chain is put in the foot of it, and it's dropped over the side. And we had a chaplain, and he performed a short service, and it's quite a touching thought,
yeah,
process to see.
We've heard that. I hadn't really quite thought about all the logistics on that. That Yeah, that's a pretty big deal. Mm-hmm.
How about, Les, any other of your mates on your boat that, whether they're still with us or they're not, we want to remember as many different names as we can. Is there anybody in your crew that you'd like to mention or give a shout out to or tell a story of?
The only story we had the name of Hangover. That was the name that was given by the other ships to our crews. We're the crew of the Hangover. We had big cocktail glasses painted on the bow of our boat, of our boats. If they're going to call us Hangover, well, we wanted to...
Make sure you merited the name, huh?
So we decorated all of our landing craft with big champagne glasses.
Oh, nice. That is...
Gilded. And the other crews called us the Hangover.
Oh, that is funny. Nice. So, hey, Les, you're coming in on 100 years. First of all, congratulations. What's looking back over 100 years, what would be a takeaway that you would want to share with all of us right now?
Well, I don't know if there's any one particular one that I can think of right now. I did, after I could get back in it, I went back in the reserve and served another 22 years in the Naval Reserve.
Did you end up going to Korea during the Korean War?
Yeah, after World War II, as soon as I had a job where I could go to the Reserve Center each week, I went back in the reserve and served another 22 months, awesome. Or 22 years.
Wow.
And so, Les, did you actually make it to Korea?
Yeah. I had two tours of duty with them,
huh.
You might say.
Was that radar, or what did you do there?
Yeah, I was radar. They changed that to... operations specialist, because you have so much more to do than just watch radar. You've got to be able to be a plotter and figure out whether it's friend or foe, and be able to determine if you any kind of sounds that you hear. Where are they coming from? If it's somebody trying to jam your radar, or if it's something else, and you have to be able to detect what those sounds are.
And how does somebody jam a radar? How does that happen?
Well, they can do it with different devices, electronic devices that will give you an inaccurate reading on it.
Okay.
And it's quite common now.
Okay.
They all do it.
Okay. And did you catch anyone? Were you jammed? Did you find a foe?
Pardon?
Did you find any foes on your radar during Korea?
Oh, no. No, I didn't.
Okay.
Now, Les Anderson, we are getting close to the end of the interview here. First of all, thank you. I've learned so much, Molly. This is just
me too,
really
and it's
fabulous.
always such a special treat to meet somebody who served in both World War II and Korea. Because although they were so close, only about 5 years apart, many people the Korean War was the forgotten war. And like you said, Les Anderson, things changed with the equipment and the details and the duties from one to the other.
So, Les, as we're getting near the end of the show, what is the advice, or what would you like to say to the young people of America today?
Well, be proud of your country. And you don't necessarily have to join a military unit, but respect your flag and respect the military for what they have done. that's, I think, my advice for them.
Yeah. And Les Anderson, when you look at the American flag today, what do you think about?
Well, I'm proud of it. I've got two of them that have flown over my gravesite in Fort Logan Cemetery, and I'm proud of them.
Okay. So explain that. So they, how does that work exactly?
Well, you know, they put those, the scouts put the...
Oh, right.
On each grave, and I put some of mine on there too, my graveside, and of course that's where my wife is buried, and I shall be buried there too. So I wanted to get those, I'd leave them there overnight and get them the next day, and I've got two of them. One of them I give to my great-grandson, but the other I'm displaying in front of my apartment.
I just love that. Hey, Les Anderson, you're going to turn 100 years old within the next few days. What's your celebration look like?
Well, I don't know. I worked for the railroad after service there, and they're going to give me an award of some kind today, too. Later on in the day.
Nice.
Awesome. Les, so 100 years of living. I love music from the 40s. Do you have a favorite song or band from your 100 years that you still love today?
Well, no, not really. But I like the old-time music. So, today, I don't care much for it.
Yeah, I don't see that the young people of today will be playing much of this music these days for their grandchildren, at least not from what I can tell. So, well, Les Anderson, World War II veteran, going to be turning 100 years old within the next few days. This is truly an honor. Thank you so much for this wonderful interview. Molly and I greatly appreciate it.
We sure do. Thank you, Les Anderson. We appreciate you. God bless you.
Oh, thank you.
All right. I'll talk to you soon.
Well, this is the AmeriChicks, Molly Vogt and Kim Munson, in this World War II project that we have the great honor of doing. The interviews are changing our lives. And to be able to talk to these folks that stood against tyranny and evil and were willing to risk this so that we pass on something good to the next generation, it truly is changing our lives. So thank you, Les Anderson. God bless you. God bless your family. And God bless America.
Join us next time for the World War II Project and your hosts, the AmeriChicks, Molly Vogt and Kim Munson. Until then, keep saluting the greatest generation.